Well, I'm the third leg of this three-legged stool, and I have plenty of time, right, Fred? And I'm going to be I'm going to talk about some laboratory work, but I'm also going to be a little preachy and philosophical about how important host plant resistance is. And I have one disaster slide. This is down in Marianna. My work, I do it in Northeast Arkansas, about an hour from Fred and Glenn, but I'm on sandy soil, so usually I can get in and plant on time. And so their disaster this year, this is a disaster that I had down in Marianna with really, really severe infestations, and it was this was a Georgia line. Dr. Borland had given me...
Is he here, Teen? That's your line. Okay.
Host plant resistance is an ideal IPM tactic for tarnished plant, and I do not think that we emphasize it enough and talk about it enough this time of year to help our producers make some decisions. It's easy to use. It's right now inexpensive to the producer. You're making decisions on varieties. So look at Dr. Borland's resistance work and help you make some decisions about your lines. It's a cumulative effects, mostly compatible with other tactics. Host plant resistance is one of several cultural control methods, and this is an agronomic practice that will reduce pest abundance and damage below that which would have occurred if the practice not been used. It shouldn't be used. It should be used in conjunction with other control tactics. Integrated pest management, we're integrating different practices, not just chemical control. We're looking at also cultural control and other practices. And I think it's really important to remember what that I on IPM stands for. Most of the research, applied research we do on host plant resistance now is all based on work of Painter back in the 1950s. And he came up with three categories of resistance: anti-zoonosis, anti-biosis, and tolerance. He called the anti-zoonosis part the non-preference. It was changed, the title was changed in the 70s. And we can think of this non-preference, anti-zoonosis, like trichomes in cotton. Anti-biosis, think about gossypaw, affects the biology of the pest. And tolerance, an example would be compensation. So all of these are components of this overall system that we think about of this IPM, host plant resistance components. Michael Stout wrote a really nice paper a year ago. It's in Insect Science. And he proposes a new framework that we think about host plant resistance that's really more combined with some of the work that's being done in insect-plant interaction ecology work that I really, really like, and I think it might help us to communicate a little bit more with some of the more basic researchers that are working. And he proposes using two terms under this host plant resistance umbrella: resistance and tolerance. And where the resistance would be thinking about what the insects do, reducing the insect injury, and then the tolerance, lessening that damage resulting from the injury. So if I put together this little flow chart here, thinking about these two under this big host plant resistance umbrella of resistance and tolerance. So we think about finding and utilizing and finding, accepting, and utilizing the host, how resistance might affect those. Then once they've accepted what kind of injury they do and whether or not that injury is then translated into damage. So that you'd have these preference and anti-biosis components here under resistance, and the constitutive and induced. So constitutive might be, but gossypaw is always present. Induced part of the host plant resistance part would be plant defense compounds that come about after injury. And insect ecologists sometimes talk about direct and indirect parts of this resistance, where direct might be that injury response directly affecting the pest, and indirect maybe the host volatiles that the plant host volatiles that are produced that then natural enemies respond to when they come in and help you come to the rescue. And I'm also thinking about on this umbrella would be thinking about phenological escape. So Dr. Borland's, Dr. Studebaker's plots this year not getting planted till the middle of June. Not very much of that didn't give us a very head start on plant earliness to escape plant bugs. So those are real important things to think about. It's really difficult sometimes to separate these, the finding and then this phenological escape part. So that's was really my charge with coming up with some of these laboratory evaluations, just to separate these out. So I'm really kind of in this accept and utilize part in my part. So that's what I'm going to talk about. And when I started this work, I wanted to look at these two extremes, the frigo, and then looking at this these morphological differences with the extrafloral nectaries. The choice tests that I started with were to look at these two lines that were really, really far apart as far as resistance. It was an Arcot line of Dr. Borland's. It was a nectaryless line, and then this Texas frigo. So these were about as far apart as we could get. And we were taking advantage of the way the plant bugs, the effects of them feeding on squares. Little tiny squares. They have this solid to liquid feeding method. So you've got the plant bug that's honing in on the plant parts. It's sawing and squirting in these digestive enzymes, and then it sucks up this digested slurry. And small tiny squares, that activity, they'll just hollow it up, and the plant and the square will fall off. As the square gets bigger, they'll probe and then they hone in on the anthers, and so you can see where they fed. So we look at those damaged anthers, and you can use counting the number of damaged anthers. You can spend some time. Dr. Borland's method of looking at the dirty flowers, that's essentially what's going on, because that honing in on those individual anthers, the flower goes ahead and opens up, and if the injury's not that much, you may get a perfectly normal bowl. So I'm looking at this part right here of where the plant bug has fed. And it's kind of like taking a bite of an apple and waiting a little while, and you get that browning in the apple. That's what I'm looking at, where these plant bugs have fed. We set up these little choice tests. It's a little arena test. Started back in 2004, 2005, looking at how the nymphs might choose between these varieties. This looks like it took about 10 minutes to come up with, but it didn't. It was a little bit more time. We've used water foam. This is what florists use, and take these individual plant parts and put them in, and we allow the nymphs to feed, and then we come back and see what they've been doing. Use nice little Latin square designs, and so we let them feed for 24 hours, take the bugs off, let it rest for 24 hours, and then go back and dissect those and look at the feeding. It's real important to have good controls to make sure there's no pre-existing conditions if you're feeding, you're collecting those squares from the field, and also to have control boxes with no bugs, and we just cover those with netting. Looking at the frigo and the Arcot nectarless lines, all kinds of different comparisons we made over time with bracts, removing the bracts, without bracts, small squares. These aren't really small squares. This would be like medium-sized squares, about the size of a pencil eraser, versus bigger squares, which size of the end of your finger. But no matter what, there's that big old black line there. That's that bar. That's frigo. And this was a very simple presentation of these. This was just looking at the percentage of squares exhibiting injury. So no matter if the bract was present or if we peeled them off, we saw that these nymphs preferred frigo. Did this over several years, different ways, frigo, and added some other lines. But there's that frigo preference we found over and over. So here's my first results of my choice test to Dr. Borland, and it was very profound. I told him that bugs like frigo. He looked at me over top of his glasses. Is that all you got there, Dr. Thing? I think it's important that we hone in on thinking about these mechanisms, that it's not just about the BRAC. There's something else going on. And so maybe we need to look at this a little closer about what we think about that whole continuum of looking at host plant resistance, what's going on here. So there's pictures of my BRAC-less lines that we would allow the plant bugs to choose from. So we looked at maybe something a little more ecological relevance as far as, the plant bug adults have come in, they've laid their eggs, what about the survival of nymphs on these lines? And I did lots and lots of different little piddle plot things about plant bugs surviving on squares, and then counting how many individual anthers might be. We never really saw much difference between anything going on with these kinds of seedling, because this would be so easy if we could just sprout some seeds and put some plant bugs on there and see if they died. Maybe one of these days this might be a useful technique. This water foam is real handy with plants, by the way. But this is what I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about, this test when looking at using cuttings as an evaluation tool. If we think about the cotton season, I think I'm going to use these cuttings, but thinking about where plant bugs come in our typical season in Arkansas, if we get a square, the square plants start squaring about 35 days after planting, and flowers at 60 days after planting, we cut out. We typically have a really good winter in North Arkansas. We don't have any flower buds right now. It's 1 degree up there, that our adults are overwintering, and when the first flowers of spring trilock come out, they'll lay eggs. After that generation, those adults are the ones we have coming in. The earliest we probably see an egg laid out there is going to be a first square. The temperatures that we have in North Arkansas, it's going to take about 30 days to go from nymph to nymph. So there's your first. If we've got those eggs coming in, Dr. Studebaker, that's where they are. They're hatching right there. And if they've found a good field, they're going to just stay right there in that spot. And in just a few more days, the next one, that's when we get the big ones. So this is how important earliness is to avoid that third generation that's so huge. And they're moving around and selecting. So delay and not having good crop earliness and good practices that do that can be really bad. So one of the things thinking about how relevant those the first bite of those squares are, we started doing some work that Dr. Phil Tugwell used to do. He used to use field cages in insecticide tests. Well, we use these with varieties. We release nymphs in cages, and 3 days later we'd go back and take the cage to the lab and count how many nymphs had survived. We look little first instar nymphs and third instar nymphs, and you have to have really good plants, you have to have really good insects, you have to have good people that know what they're doing. This is very time consuming and hard to do this kind of work. It has to be pre-flower cotton. You have to be in an area where there's not that many bugs from the native population. You do things in the morning when it's cool, and you have to have lots of good checks to make sure you don't have any of those pre-existing conditions of native populations coming in. We collect those plants, bring them back in, and look for the numbers of bugs dead and alive after 3 days. We've also done this kind of technique with greenhouse. This would be so handy to be able to do this in the greenhouse. We'd have to go out in the field, do this. But this is the method that I was really looking to get for. We tried all kinds of different pieces of these plants, but eventually, with bugs surviving and not surviving and the plants melting, we found that these cuttings worked really well. So you take the uppermost 6 to 7 squaring nodes, the first position squares are retained, clip off some of those leaves, and we put it down in the floral foam. Then we cage the bugs on there. So a big block of floral foam that's got water on it, and cage these the plant bugs on there. We looked at tried to use first instar tarnished plant bugs, or third or fourth instar. Those really worked. After 3 days, count the numbers, dead and alive. Oops. This is in the field. This is field cages. This is looking at these two big difference plants of the Frigo and the Arcot nectarilis, and this is mortality. The green will be the Frigo, and this dark red will be the more resistant Arcot. This is just plant bug mortality on field cages after 3 days. We got nice separations: 15% mortality on the Frigo, 32% on the nectarilis. Field cages in another year we got the same kind of trends: small first instar nymphs, large third, fourth instar nymphs, this big the two to three fold difference in mortality after 3 days on these lines. So this seemed like a nice way to look at this survival of the plant bugs on this, thinking about utilization of the host plant. If I take the cuttings in the lab, so we take those cuttings, bring them in from the field. This is got similar results, similar differences between the susceptible and the resistant lines, and those trends continue. This is field growth cuttings in different year, the same kind of thing, small and large. So I was encouraged by that we could see some differences in these. Greenhouse didn't work, so hardly saw any differences at all. Nice survival. Plants in the greenhouse are different than plants in the field. Yep. So maybe we will soon have resistant lines where that resistance is. We could see it in the greenhouse, but this would have been too convenient, I think. So on our terminal cuttings, we could measure differences in a susceptible and a moderately resistant line, and we got similar results either in the field cages or on field-grown plant cuttings. If we do a preference test with my lab workers, they preferred to bring the plants inside and do the work. The work to do those field cages is really, really hard and takes good people and lots of early mornings to do that well. Greenhouse cotton didn't work as well. Didn't see any difference. He spent a lot of time and not getting anything. So where and how the test plants were grown mattered. And so people, good bugs, good plants, and good techniques, and you can figure these things out. I'd like to acknowledge some of my technicians and students that worked on this. Jennifer Lund and Stephen Wingard and Kamala Neely, these were really excellent folks, good wranglers of insects, and then took good plants. Larry Fowler at Judd Hill Farm, he was kept the insecticide off my plants and did really, really well. So good folks. And then I want to acknowledge Dr. Phil Tugwell. He was really, what we know about plant bugs in Northeast Arkansas is really based on his 30 years of work with this. It was really important. So thank you.
Any questions? Well, I hope you learned today that I'm privileged to work with two very good entomologists. And that, I used to think that was an oxymoron, a good entomologist, but I appreciate the opportunity to work with these two.